Chapter 1. Women Who Wait. The Battle of Moorland City took fewer than 3 hours. The clansmen who participated knew the outcome immediately. The dead were dead and cared no more. The seriously wounded were fortunate if in the care of medicants and mercifully unconscious. Others experienced the agony of waiting for either help or death. Those unharmed, or the walking wounded, felt the elation of victory or numbness from what they had witnessed or endured. Beneath the orbiting AI, other humans waited. While the logical, disinterested sentients observed the battle from space, tens of thousands of other beings, emotionally invested, waited for news. For some, word came within hours. For others, days. For some, months, if ever.
Urluina Moorland.
Even from the highest building in Moorland City, the wife of Hetman Jinfor Moorland couldn't see the battlefield, but she heard the thunder of hooves, the cannon and musket fire, a pause more firing than nothing for 2 hours. Finally, a long trail of horsemen and wagons moved over hillocks into the city. Her eyes were still good enough to see that the wagons held wounded and dead. She didn't see the banners of the Moorland leadership. "Maybe they're still at the battlefield," she told herself, "particularly the Hetman and his sons." Not that she worried for the safety of her husband, or even for her oldest son, Owain. Jinfor had not been the husband of her dreams, with his harshness, overweening self-importance, and stubborn refusal to face his own stupidity, and she had hated every day of her marriage and life in Clan Moorland. Unfortunately, as a daughter of Hetman Pewit, she'd had no choice in the political marriage. The only lights in her life had been 3 babies, 2 sons, Owain and Kedem, and a daughter, Nyssa. Owain she'd loved until by age 7 he began changing into a copy of his father. Now, only a dim memory reminded her of when she had loved her eldest son. Kedem, the younger son, demonstrated everything his older brother lacked: kindness, inquisitiveness, and strength. He was strong enough to avoid emulating his father and brother. She knew that other clans, particularly Keelan, chose the next hetman among all of the sons and not by primogeniture. And even then, only with the approval of the Boyerman. She had never suggested to Jinfor that he choose Kedem as heir, knowing her husband would dismiss copying Keelan. So far, Owain had 3 daughters, but no sons. Despite her efforts to suppress the thought which caused her intermittent guilt, Urluina admitted to herself that if Jinfor died, she wouldn't mourn if Owain followed suit and Kedem became hetman. Footsteps on stone announced someone behind her. Slow footsteps, as if made by an old or feeble person, or someone hesitant to approach. She turned to see Abbot Kelvin of St. Warland's Abbey. He was young for an abbot and not feeble, but his pale, grim expression foretold distress.
"Urluina,"
he said softly, confirming bad news by the use of her first name.
"News came. The Narthani are withdrawing back to the territories. But Moorland suffered grievous losses, far worse than we first feared."
"Who is dead?"
she asked, her voice emotionless. The abbot needed no further words to know she asked about her husband and 2 sons.
"God knows I'm sorry to tell you, Urluina, but it's confirmed that the hetman and both of your sons fell in a charge on the Narthani."
She didn't speak for a long moment.
"And there's no doubt?" "None, I'm afraid." "Thank you, Abbot. I'd like to be alone now. Of course. But I'll be in the main hall if you want to talk or need me for any reason.
She turned back, looking out to the west as the abbot's footsteps receded. She would mourn Kedem later. For now, nothing held her in Moorland. She would take Nyssa and within 2 hours be on her way back home to Pewit. She could do nothing for Kedem, but Nyssa needed to be out of the reach of Moorland factions. Her daughter was a simpleton, a good-natured girl of 15 with the mind of a 5-year-old. If Nyssa stayed in Moorland, she would become a pawn in the struggle to define the new clan leadership. With the hetman and both of his sons dead and with no grandsons, Nyssa might be forced into a marriage to secure a hetman claim. When Nyssa was safe, then Urlwina would mourn her youngest son. Breda Keelan. Another hetman's wife also waited, but the news took longer to reach her at Cairnford, capital of Keelan province, 130 miles south-southeast of Moorland City. In Breda Keelan's 27-year marriage to College Keelan, she had seen him off into danger many times, mainly in the early years before his father died and College became hetman. But those times were nothing like now. When College had left this time, she watched him lead 500 armed Keelan men on the way to joining hundreds more Keelanders and men from the Gwillimer and Meetak clans, 2,200 men going to the aid of the Moorland clan, invaded by an Arthani army and the allied Iwal and Selfsul clans. The last report, now 2 days old, said that men of 10 clans faced an Arthani army on the plain west of Moorland City. Since then, no updates had arrived. Whether her husband survived was surely already determined, and so she waited. After the men headed north to whatever fate lay ahead, Breda insisted that she and her 3 daughters eat every meal together. She needed her children around her and intuited that they needed to stay near her and not retreat into solitary fears. The 4 of them ostensibly went about their daily lives, which fooled no one. Their meals were quiet affairs, strained conversations interleaved with draining silences as each groped for words without voicing what consumed everyone's thoughts. Despite doing their best to maintain the strength expected of the hetman's family, they had limits. One night, Breda woke to find her youngest daughter, 12-year-old Merid, huddled next to her in bed. The child had part of her nightshirt stuffed in her mouth, stifling sobs so as not to wake her mother. When Breda enveloped Merid in an embrace, the child spit out the cloth. "Oh, mother, I'm so scared. What's happened to father?" she sobbed in a strangled voice.
"I know, child, I know. I'm afraid too. But all we can do is pray and wait for news."
Breda had no sooner spoken than her 2 other daughters, Anid and Sinwin, stood in the bedroom door, holding on to each other, listening to their mother's words.
"And Yosef?" said a sobbing Anid, the 2nd youngest daughter.
"And Yosef," agreed their mother.
Anid and Sinwin rushed to their mother and sister, and the 4 held tight to one another. After several minutes, Breda cleared her throat.
"We all will keep praying for good news soon, but your father would want us to keep faith that everything will be all right."
She comforted the others as best she could and fought not to show the depth of her own fear. An hour passed before mother and daughters, huddled together, fell asleep. The stars had begun to fade with the approaching daylight when Norlin, the teenage boy who worked at the manor, pounded on the bedroom door. Breda jerked upright, followed by her daughters.
"Send Breda! There's a rider with a message from the hetman!" Breda untangled herself from her daughters and ran to the bedroom door, not thinking to put a robe over her nightdress. Norlin appeared anxious and held out a sealed envelope.
The rider said he changed horses 4 times and rode all night. He looks it.
She tore open the envelope to reveal a single folded sheet.
Dearest, I am scratching out this short message and sending it by rider instead of semaphore before dark, since the station manager said clouds and rain were stopping transmission between here and Keelan. More news will come later, but I want to assure you I'm safe, as are Josef and Vortig. We are calling it a victory, since the Narthani are withdrawing back to Iwil province. You will hear more later, but all I'll say now is that it was terrible. We fought a battle, and although the Narthani turned back, we estimate about 100 Keelan dead and many wounded. I believe I will be here in Moreland City for another day before we start home, so I should see you in 3 to 4 days. With all my love, Kalich. She read the words again and started a third time when Anand called out,
Mother, what is it? Is it about father?
Breda looked up to see 3 fearful faces circling her.
Oh, sorry, children. Yes, it's from your father, and he says he's all right.
Shouts and tears ensued, then Merid spoke.
And Josef?
What about Josef?
Your father says Josef is also safe.
They should be back here in 3 to 4 days.
We have to send word to Mera,
said Merid.
It'll be light in another 2 hours, said Breda. The sky is clear here, so a semaphore message can go out as soon as the stations can pass signals. Sinwin, run get me quill, ink, and paper so I can write a message to Mera. We'll have Norlin take it to the semaphore station in Kernford to go out as soon as possible.
2 hours later, Breda sat on the manor's front veranda and gazed at clear skies dotted with scattered clouds. She assumed her semaphore message to Mera had been sent on its way through the intervening stations between Kernford and Abersford. Her emotions were conflicted. Exhilaration that her husband was safe and guilt at her contentment when so many other Keelan families would soon hear the news she had avoided of a loved one dead or seriously wounded. She stood to go inside. She had things to do. Halfway to the manor front door, she caught movement from a corner of her eye and she turned her head. A rider approached on the tree-lined drive leading 100 yards to the manor. It was Essel Havant, one of the workers at the Kernford semaphore station. Delivering messages from the station to Keelan Manor occurred so often, Kalich had joked they should have built the station next to the manor to save on horses and the station workers' time. Havant frequently made several trips a day to the manor, so often that Mera once said they should count him as part of the manor staff. A friendly, though nondescript man with thinning hair, he always had a good word for everyone. Normally, Breda passed a few pleasant words with Essel, but this seemed like the wrong time to receive new messages. She stopped, her hand touching her throat. What if the first message that morning was an error, or something had changed? Her husband hadn't come home yet. Anything was possible. Havant pulled up by the front steps and called out from his horse.
San Keelan! Wonderful news came in on the semaphore! The clans defeated the Narthani!
He pulled out a sheet of paper from a saddlebag and waved it in the air.
The message is to all Cadeli on the island. The station master is having copies made as fast as possible and distributing them. I'm delivering copies, and of course, one is for you and your family.
By now, Breda had descended the steps and rushed to the horse. Havant reached down and handed the sheet to her, and then he turned his horse and rode off. She read the paper immediately. From Headman Oros, to all clans people of Cadelium, on the 4th day, 3rd 6th day, month of Mephilton, year 414 of the settlement of Cadelium, on the plain west of Moreland City, The free clans of Cadalia met an Arthani army supported by Iwal and Selfsili's clans. After desperate fighting, the Iwal clan was crushed, and the Arthani suffered severe losses and are withdrawing. Praise God. She went inside and called her daughters to come read it. Then she had them gather all workers at the manor that day, so that they too could read a semaphore message that would live in Cadellium history. Breda proposed a celebratory libation. They read the message aloud over and over, and after the final reading, Breda went to Cullish's study, put the sheet on his desk, and smoothed out a few wrinkles created after numerous hand-to-hand passages. Her husband would want to keep this paper, perhaps even frame it. Mara Kolsko-Keelan. Mara determined that today she would work on being nice to everyone she interacted with, in penitence for her behavior the last several days. The previous evening, she had cursed at Alien for dropping a dish as the elderly woman cleaned up after evening meal. Alien's intimidated look and glistening eyes jolted Mara.
Oh, Alien, I'm sorry I said that to you. Please excuse me. There's just so much going on.
That's all right, Senmara. What with the baby coming and Sir Joseph away to merciful God knows what, it's no wonder you're, you know, excitable.
An apology given and accepted, Mara still noticed Alien keeping a cautious eye and excusing herself for the evening with more eagerness than usual. Only when preparing for bed did Mara reflect on her behavior the last few days. It hadn't been the first time she'd snapped at Alien and Brock. Plus, she'd brusquely declined an invitation for a midday gathering in Abersford with several women she knew. She also recalled sniping at Sen Murfield, Joseph's partner in papermaking. She even stewed over delays in developing the University of Abersford. Her husband, Joseph, had asked her to take on the responsibility of serving as chancellor of the university. A scholasticum, as Cadelli termed formal collections of scholastics, but with expanded numbers and a dedicated building complex. Inherently interested in the concept, she had eagerly taken on the task. She also recognized it as a venue to establish an identity based on her ability and not just on being someone's daughter or wife. Dealing with the myriad details of planning infrastructure and recruiting scholastics, her worry about Joseph and her father and the need for naps and relieving her bladder all made for a cranky pregnant woman. Thus, she decided, for the next day and for as long as she could, to remain civil, no matter what preoccupied her mind. She apologized again to Alien the next morning and went to the barn to find Brock, who responded to her apology with a grunt and returned to cleaning stalls. Mara then walked into Abersford, slowly, given her condition, and found Murfield in the paper factory. She didn't outright apologize, but she did her best to sound pleasant and tried to seem spontaneous when mentioning how much Joseph respected him. She then sat on a bench in the town square for an hour, practicing smiling at passers-by and chit-chatting with those she knew. She didn't return home until near midday to find a nervous Alien pacing on the porch.
Senmara, where have you been? A semaphore message came for you, and the Abersford station operator has looked for you the last several hours. He's been by the house twice.
Mara's throat constricted and her eyes widened.
A message?
From who?
I don't know, said Alien. But he left it the last time he came by. It's on the dining room table.
Mara rushed into the adjoining room. There, on the table, lay a single sheet of paper, folded, not sealed, and wrinkled, as if it had been carried around for several hours, which it had been. She snatched it off the table, unfolded and read it, then sank onto a wooden chair by the table and wept. Aelion rushed to her, knelt, and put one hand on her knee and the other on her shoulder.
"San Mera, I pray it isn't bad news about Yosef."
Mera choked back tears enough to say,
"He's safe. Father, too. That's all it says. Yosef will be home in a few days."
Mera wiped her face as she hiccuped in her attempt to stifle sobs.
"I'll be all right. Thank you, Aelion. Don't be concerned."
An hour later, Mera sat on the front veranda, looking out at the ocean. She couldn't remember the last time she had cried so hard, even though it had lasted only a minute. She ruminated on the cause, which led to a conclusion both surprising and soothing. "I knew the marriage to Yosef was a logical decision for both of us. We never expressed words of affection. I felt comfortable with him, as he did with me, and obviously he found me attractive, or at least enough to enjoy sharing a bed. I told myself we had a good marriage, but it's obviously more than just acceptable. When he left with Father to go to Moreland and face the Narthani, I hardly spoke to him. Then, the thought of him dead. I can't bear even the thought. A life without him seems desolate. I'm overjoyed that Father is safe, but I don't think I would have cried like that only for Father's safety. It was Yosef. I love him the way I know Mother loves Father."
Even so, part of her shied away from saying the words. After all, he hadn't said them either. But why should that hold her back? Except for a fear he didn't feel the same? She knew what the word would say, or her mother. Her love of him shouldn't be conditional on his love for her. Sirlip Dogan. Far from Moreland City, 7,258 miles, a Narthani woman washed the clothes of her husband, two daughters, and three of her five sons. Hands rough and red from decades of that task, she kneaded the clothes in a tub of water, brushed aside hair streaked with gray, and stretched joints stiffened from a lifetime of work. The Dogan family labored on farmland belonging to Nuthrat Metin, a colonel in the Narthani army. Her husband worked as the property's blacksmith, with two sons apprenticed to their father and a third son who oversaw teams of slaves working the crop fields. The latter work made the Dogan family constantly aware that even with their hard life, many others suffered in worse conditions. The Dogan family derived from a people conquered by the Narthani 70 years earlier, a people now recognized as Narthani, even if from among the lower levels of that society, whereas the Metin slaves had descended from peoples conquered within the last two generations. Her grandparents were their family's first generation released from slavery. Narthani custom required their release, because the family had served faithfully and without rebelling when in slave status. Sirlip remembered stories told to her by Grandmother Sirona, the only knowledge passed on of the family's origin. Sirlip comforted herself that three of her sons had solid positions in service on the Metin estate, and that her daughters would likely marry men also in Metin service or men from neighboring estates. She would have those five children near her. 4 years previously, the Narthani had ordered her eldest two sons, Ergin and Yazar, to report for induction. Sirlip and her husband had known the call would inevitably come. Yet they felt consoled when the estate's master, Metin, was pleased enough with the family service to promise to keep the two sons within the units he commanded. He assured the parents that no further call would come to claim their other three sons. Serving under Metin also meant the sons could communicate with their family more often than most men in the Narthani army, where service might be thousands of miles and months of travel away. There had even been two visits home when the two sons accompanied Metin, who, while in distant posts most of the time, made rare inspection visits to the property. Once the entire family reunited again for 2 months, when Metin brought his family to stay at the estate after his long tour at an Iroquinic front. The precious reunion turned bitter when the two sons left again, this time for an extended duty serving under Metin in a distant land Serlip had never heard of. In the following 4 years, the family received 3 short letters, both written by Yazar, because Ergin had never taken to the limited schooling workers children could attend. Metin granted troops originating from his estate the privilege of sending their letters with his in a mail packet. When a year passed since Serlip had received the last letter, she told herself it was due to the distance, the mail having to come by ship and then overland, and the burdens of her son's duties. Still yesterday, she felt disappointed yet again when a mail packet from Metin to the estate overseer arrived with no letters from her sons. 2 years passed before Serlip learned that Ergin had fallen in a battle on an island named Cadellium. The fate of Yazar remained forever unknown.